Penguin Random House Audio presents Evil Geniuses, The Unmaking of America, A Recent History. This is the author, Kurt Anderson. For Anne and Kate and Lucy. We must make our choice. We may have democracy, or we may have wealth concentrated in the hands of a few, but we can't have both. Louis Brandeis. The crisis consists precisely in the fact that the old is dying and the new cannot be born. In this interregnum, a great variety of morbid symptoms appear. Antonio Gramsci. Strategic inflection points can mean an opportunity to rise to new heights, but it may just as likely signal the beginning of the end. Andy Grove. Introduction. When you reach your 50s, it gets easier to notice the big ways in which the world has or hasn't changed since you were young, both the look and feel of things and people's understandings of how society works. A half century of life is enough to provide some panoramic perspective, letting you see and sense arcs of history firsthand, like when an airplane reaches the altitude where the curvature of the earth becomes visible. Some of the arcs of historical change are obvious, their paths as well as their causes. The equality and empowerment of women is one of those big duh ones. But other important historical arcs, more complicated or obscure, have to be figured out. That's how I came to write my last nonfiction book, a not-so-obvious American history called Fantasyland, How America Went Haywire. I'd noticed that in so many ways, as Stephen Colbert joked on his first episode of his old nightly show, America had become increasingly divided between those who think with their head and those who know with their heart. From the 1960s and 70s on, I realized, America had really changed in this regard. Belief in every sort of make-believe had spun out of control, in religion, science, politics, and lifestyle, all of them merging with entertainment in what I called the fantasy industrial complex. In that book, I explained the deep, centuries-long history of this American knack for creating and believing the excitingly untrue. As soon as I finished writing Fantasyland, we elected a president who was its single most florid and consequential expression ever, a poster boy embodying all its themes. But that long-standing, chronic American condition that turned into an acute crisis is just half the story of how and why we've come to grief these last few decades. The other part concerns the transformation of our social system that started in the 1970s and 80s, helped along by a simultaneous plunge into compulsive nostalgia and wariness of the new and unfamiliar. Whereas Fantasyland concerned American centuries-old weakness for the untrue and irrational and its spontaneous and dangerous flowering since the 1960s, Evil Geniuses chronicles the quite deliberate re-engineering of our economy and society since the 1960s by a highly rational confederacy of the rich, the right, and big business. From my parents' young adulthood in the 1930s and 40s through my young adulthood in the 1970s, American economic life became a lot more fair and democratic and secure than it had been when my parents were children in the 1920s and early 30s. But then, all of a sudden, around 1980, that progress slowed, stopped, and in many ways reversed. I didn't start fully appreciating and understanding the nature and enormity of that change until the turn of this century, after the country had been transformed. In 2002, when several spectacular corporate financial frauds were exposed and their CEO perpetrators prosecuted, I published a long screed in the New York Times blaming Wall Street. "If infectious greed is the virus, New York is the center of the outbreak," I wrote, because it is also, inarguably, the money center of America and the world, the capital of capitalism. It was New York investment bankers who drove the mergers and acquisitions deal culture of the 80s and 90s and who most aggressively oversold the myth of synergy that justified it. It was they who invented the novel financial architectures of Enron and WorldCom. It was the example of New York investment bankers earning gigantic salaries for doing essentially nothing, knowing the right people, talking smoothly, showing up at closings, that encouraged business people out in the rest of America to feel entitled to smoke and mirrors cash bonanzas of their own. A few years later, one very cold morning just after Thanksgiving, I had another slow road to Damascus moment from whatever I had been, complacent neoliberal, to whatever I was becoming, appalled social democrat. I was actually on the road to Epley Airfield in Omaha after my first visit to my hometown since both my parents had died, sharing a minivan jitney from a hotel with a couple of central casting airline pilots, tall, fit, white men around my age, one wearing a leather jacket. We chatted. To my surprise, even shock, both of them spent the entire trip sputtering and whining about being baited and switched when their employee ownership shares of United Airlines had been evaporated by its recent bankruptcy, about the default of their pension plan, about their CEO's recent 40% pay raise, about the company to which they'd devoted their entire careers but no longer trusted at all. In effect, about changing overnight from successful all-American middle-class professionals who'd worked hard and played by the rules into disrespected, cheated, sputtering, whining chumps. When we got to the airport, I said goodbye and good luck, and at the little bookstore there that contains a kind of shrine to the local god Warren Buffett and his company, Berkshire Hathaway, bought a newspaper. In it, I read an article about that year's record-setting bonuses on Wall Street. The annual revenues of Goldman Sachs were greater than the annual economic output of two-thirds of the countries on Earth, a treasure chest from which the firm was disbursing the equivalent of $69 million to its CEO and an average of $800,000 apiece to everybody else at the place. Historical sums of money are pretty meaningless because of inflation. $1,000 in 2020 is the same as $850 in 2010, $500 in 1990, $150 in 1970, and so on. So, throughout this book, unless I specify otherwise, all dollar amounts are inflation-adjusted, even when I don't mention that I've rendered a historical sum in today's dollars or that it was equivalent to the larger present-day amount. This was 2006, before Wall Street started teetering, before the financial crash, before the Great Recession. The amazing real estate bubble had not yet popped, and the economy was still apparently rocking. I was writing a regular column for New York Magazine, so after reading and thinking some more, I summarized my understanding of how an egregiously revised American social contract had been put in place, take it or leave it, without much real debate. "This is not the America in which we grew up," I wrote. By which I meant America of the several very prosperous decades after World War II, when the income share of the super-rich was reasonably cut back by more than half. The rich were still plenty rich, and American capitalism worked fine. I wrote about how, since the 1980s, the piece of the income pie taken each year by the rich has become as hugely disproportionate as it was in the 1920s, how an average CEO now gets paid several hundred times the salary of his average worker, a gap that's an order of magnitude larger than it was in the 1970s, and how most Americans' wages had barely budged. I wrote that during the past two decades, we've not only let economic uncertainty and unfairness grow to grotesque extremes, we've also inured ourselves to the spectacle. By we, I meant the mostly liberal, mostly affluent New Yorkers and other cosmopolites who read New York Magazine. After this 25-year run of pedal-to-the-metal hypercapitalism, I wrote, it was now time to ease up and share the wealth some. Because the future that frightens me isn't so much a too-Hispanic U.S. caused by unchecked Mexican immigration, but a Latin-Americanized society with a callous oligarchy gated off from a growing mass of screwed-over peons. We needed to take seriously the rising anger and disgust about an American economic system that seems more and more rigged in favor of the extremely fortunate. Populism has gotten a bad odor, and not just among plutocrats. For most of the political chattering class, it is at least faintly pejorative. But I think that's about to change. When economic hope shrivels and the rich become cartoons of swinish privilege, why shouldn't the middle class become populists? I remember thinking this was why my professors in college had used the terms political economics and the political economy as distinct from simply economics and the economy. For one thing, economics has the connotation of pure science, suggesting that organizing production and pay and investment and taxes and all the rest is just math. Where
sample complete. Ready to continue?